Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today we have Ira Harris and Daniel Lacalle. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities for over 40 years. He is now and also was CME director from 1997 to 2003. And Daniel is an investment manager and has been a professor of economics. He has a PhD in economics, author of Escape from the Central Bank Trap, Life in the Financial Markets, and The Energy World is Flat. He writes frequently at the Mises Institute. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Richard, very much. Thanks for having us.
Great. I thought we'd just jump in terms of how you see things happening in the financial markets, in the economy, with regard to the implications of the COVID virus. If you'd like to begin, Daniel.
Yep. Thank you. Well, the way that I see what's unraveling is quite concerning. Governments and central banks have decided to take massive action, probably too early. And most of the action that central banks and governments have implemented, most of the measures, are measures oriented towards trying to mitigate a crisis like the one of 2008. However, this is not a crisis like the one of 2008. As such, demand-side policies or measures aimed at increasing credit are likely to generate much worse implications than the positive effects. And what we are living is what was initially a supply shock became a healthcare crisis. And the healthcare crisis was followed by a government shutdown of the economy. The decision of governments to shut down the economy has created very important effects that will likely continue to show collateral implications for a prolonged period of time. The rise in non-performing loans at banks, the collapse in commodities, and the destruction of the access to demand for most sectors is likely to generate much larger implications in the future. As such, financial markets are reacting timidly to monetary policy, and monetary policy actions, particularly large easing measures, are perceived by most investors more as a sign of weakness than as a sign of strength. And these monetary measures are not generating, obviously, the effect that central banks are looking for, to start with, because they were not achieving the results that they were looking for in the past. And secondly, because this is not an issue of the mechanism of transmission of monetary policy to credit improving. This is simply the zero sales environment for most businesses that have seen government enforced and imposed a shutdown of the economy.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, there's not much I disagree with Daniel, but it's not unusual. Richard, we go back. I always cite that Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse piece that we did. And I'm adamant, and I think that Daniel picks up on that, is that this has been a demand shock. And the demand shock is really continually to roll forward, especially as now projections about how long this is going to last and that the jobs aren't going to come back. And for all the talk and people were going, well, you don't need an infrastructure. You can't do an infrastructure program either in Europe or the U.S. because, of course, unemployment was at 3.5%, and there were no workers. But the fact of the matter is they've wasted a lot of time, and now they're wasting nothing but money, because in all that time, they never put together a comprehensive infrastructure project for all over the place, which they should have. And they could actually start be rolling it out as soon as, you know, of course, you got some clearance on when people could work and what type of protective gear. But they're nowhere close to this because they succumbed to the idea that, well, you know, everything's so good. Unemployment is so low. Unemployment is low in Germany, Japan, the UK, other parts of Europe's not quite where it ought to have been. And the U.S. at 3.5%. Well, now all you're doing is burning money, because you're just now you're chasing it and trying to create or at least hold demand in place. You can't create demand, but you can try to keep it there. So the central banks are just, of course, as usual, aiding and abetting a process, and they do it under the guise of, well, everything's a counterfactual. Well, if we didn't go this far, we would have been stuck in this problem. And so the problem with counterfactuals is, because they're so flexible in philosophy, I guess that's the best way to put them, they never come with an exit strategy. I would like to have seen the Fed say, okay, we're going to do this for 180 days. But if 180 days, this crisis starts to show its end, we're pulling back a great part of this. But there is none of that. So now the markets are going to dictate to the Fed. The Fed now dictates to the markets, but as far as exiting, the markets will dictate to the Fed. And when some type of end comes, of course, the markets will, if the Fed were to try to actually exit from any type of this massive amount of liquidity creation, the markets would send their dismay, and the Fed would, of course, buckle. And now we're stuck in this situation far longer than anybody even believes.
And Daniel, you've written a lot about the stagflationary potential. Considering demand shock and supply shock considerations, how do you see the inflation, deflation, both in financial assets and in the economy in terms of consumer prices playing out? Do you see initial deflation and then stagflation long term?
Yes, I think that what we are likely to see as the economy is reopened gradually, is a very aggressive deflationary process. Fundamentally, because we were already in an environment of overcapacity in most of the developed economies, but also because most of the improvement in demand is going to be very, very weak, and therefore will create prices to drop quite significantly. That deflationary spiral, because the unemployment that has been created in the forced shutdown will not be unwinded quickly, and because consumers also are going to likely change their pattern and their behavior afterwards because of the shock that most of us are living through, that will generate a deflationary spiral. Now, the issue is that because central banks and governments will continue to push aggressively policies to try to maintain, as we were saying before, and try to incentivize demand, what is likely to happen is that once the supply chains start to show that they're broken, as they are starting to show already, is that creates stagflation afterwards. So you have a deflationary spiral led by a massive increase in debt, massive current spending financed with huge deficits, and weakening consumption with high unemployment afterwards, that is addressed with aggressive monetary and fiscal policies that generate stagflation, because throughout that process of the forced shutdown and the very weak recovery that we are likely to experience, most businesses will only be able to manage to survive, and the supply chains are likely to be broken, added as well to what I fear is likely to be a very aggressive interventionist and protectionist range of policies coming after the pandemic stops.
Ira, do you see a similar evolution?
Well, I was kind of on the fence about this, but having, you know, gone back and forth with Dr. Hunt and I'm much more comfortable with that. And I think I see, you know, where Daniel goes, you know, I'm not necessarily going to use the word stagflation, but, you know, we are now in this situation. Richard, I don't know how long I've been doing these with you. And I know when Daniel and I were on last time, we talked about that it was the fear of deflation that drove gold higher. And I think we were both in agreement with that, because that was going to necessitate rapid and hyperaction by central banks, because their greatest fear, as they tell you over and over again, is deflation. I mean, to me, it's the only logical sense to that ridiculous 2% inflation target that they parade around. But they have this fear, and Ben Bernanke, I think, was emblematic of it. And so I, you know, 1937 is a critical date in so much of the work that he has presented over the years because of that. It's that fear of deflation, and that's what drives central banks. And that's what drives gold higher. You know, the narrative that it's inflation. No, by the time inflation comes, it's well beyond the scope. And of course, they would like nothing more than inflation, of course, because really what the fear of deflation is the fear of the overhang of massive amounts of debt. And Western society or developed society, economy, certainly with their massive amount of debt, deflation is anathema. We saw that in Japan, and Japan was better prepared to go into that type of environment, at least for a while, than anybody else in the world is. You know, whenever I hear these analysis, these correlative studies with Japan, you know, Japan, the domestic investors own 97% of the bond market in Japan going into it, and they did have real deflation. And so as a bondholder, it was politically palatable. We haven't had real deflation in the Western developed economies. And so what they're going to do here is really, you know, again, we see that it's savers and anybody with liquid assets who are being truly crucified on any effort for financial repression in order to bail out the massive amount of debt that continues to overhang the society with. And it's just irresponsible action. And of course, it's been fueled by the central bank's continued panic in the face of always trying to please financial markets. And that's where we reside now. So I'm in total agreement with Daniel. And where this goes, I can't tell you, but it's just not going to be pretty.
Yeah, I agree.
And Daniel, what do you make of U.S. dollar issues like dollar shortage, the associated repo crisis between European banks, how that has been evolving since September of late last year?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the issue of the U.S. dollar shortage was already starting to be quite evident in the past 2 years, in which when the Fed started to make its U-turn in terms of monetary policy, we were already facing about $2 trillion in the following 2 years of the maturities from emerging markets in dollar-denominated debt. In the past 20 years, dollar-denominated debt from emerging and developed economies as well, but dollar-denominated debt from non-U.S. holders has been rising dramatically and at two all-time highs.
the main reason for it, obviously, was that as the monetary policy of emerging markets became more and more aggressive, domestic savers and domestic companies did not want currency risk. So international investors, domestic savers, tried to avoid local currency risk as much as possible because of the fear of competitive devaluation or the fear of a large problem in terms of mismatch between interest rates for those yields that were being paid and the real risk behind it. So this increase, massive increase in exposure to the US dollar coincided as well with a slow but almost unstoppable reduction in export revenues in US dollars for most emerging economies, because oil prices, commodity prices were weak, and also because exports, because the economy was not growing as fast as was expected, exports were not as high as they were anticipated. So lower exports, lower revenue, tax revenues in U.S. dollars, plus increasing levels of debt in dollar-denominated bonds. So and to add to that, you have another important effect, which was that while the level of growth was very poor, the level of aggressiveness from central banks was very high, which allowed many emerging markets to live quite comfortably, actually, with twin deficits, so fiscal and trade deficits, something that was actually very rare, usually the sole widespread and so common in emerging markets. And by having twin deficits plus not weakening reserves, but reserves that were not covering comfortably the level of liabilities in US dollars, that shortage of dollars continued to grow. There was another effect that I think was important, is that throughout this process, China's dependence on the US dollar increased significantly. Remember that in the last years, policy in China has become a lot stricter. The Chinese government has implemented much tighter capital controls. The level of openness of the economy has been weakening quite significantly. And as such, many of the issuers in China had only one option, which was to issue in dollars as well. So the $3 trillion of massive foreign exchange reserves that the Chinese government accounts for basically cover about 60%, a little bit less, of the liabilities in US dollars that the Chinese economy has. So those two things are important. And in comes the euro. Here, this is a key factor of the dollar shortage, is that a very, very aggressive monetary policy of the ECB happens at the same time between 2014 and 2018 with massive asset purchases and huge rate cuts, happens at the same time as the utilization of the euro in the world starts to go down little by little. And this is a very important factor because there was some level of support for emerging markets to drive their FX reserves as the euro kept a certain level of strength as a reserve currency. However, when this started to happen, many emerging markets needed to strengthen their reserves with dollars or with gold, but not with euros or with euro assets. So the fact that, unlike the Fed, that always keeps an eye on demand for US dollars globally to at least address or at least to understand what is the extent or the not demand for euros. And what that is creating is a vacuum. You have a vacuum in the world. You have on one side a Federal Reserve that is increasing the balance sheet to unprecedented levels and lower in rates, yet the dollar shortage is actually increasing instead of decreasing, which is why basically you have the DXY index, the dollar index, and even more, the dollar relative to most emerging currencies strengthening.
Great, and Ira, you've written a lot about the dollar in your blogs this week, referencing statements by U.S. President Donald Trump on a strong dollar. If you want to elaborate and how that factors into the fragility of the financial system.
First of all, so let me ferret out what Daniel said, because I we're in total agreement. And had the euro been more successful, and I say with the euro bond, and we can have that discussion. But had it been an actual alternative, which they had always hoped it would be, to the dollar funding situation would not have been as drastic. So I can't agree more than with Daniel, and I'm glad we're ferreting that out, because I think a lot of people misunderstand that. Because if today, right now, if the Europeans, and I know that Lagarde is pushing this way, but we'll get into that. I don't want to race ahead, because that'll probably be a part of the discussion, but it would put a bid to the euro, because it would put the euro more in demand as an alternative to the dollar. This has been a gigantic mistake. And then, lo and behold, Saturday, a Bloomberg article appears written by Rich Miller, who is a very good journalist, and talking about that Donald Trump was out there talking about the benefits of a strong dollar. And I had to read it twice, three times, four times, because I couldn't actually believe it, because there can't be a worse time to discuss this. I mean, that whole economic advisory staff, are they out of their minds? Okay. Because right now the dollar issue is not a trade issue. It's a financial issue. And you don't go – this is like yelling truly a fire in a crowded theater, because the Fed is trying to do all they can to provide enough dollars into the world system. You know, the International Institute of Finance talks about $11 trillion. The BIS talks about $12 trillion. Daniel just laid out how China is steeped in dollar borrowings. And a lot of it, you know, is the responsibility of the Federal Reserve, by the way, because they've made, as Daniel talks about it, they laid all this out and made it all so comfortable for everybody until it was a classic Minsky moment. So here we are. And you don't come out and start talking about, you know, the benefits of a strong dollar. So I kept scratching my head. I go, what's going on here? This is a terrible volta face. What could prompt this? And then I recalled reading the article, which Daniel so nicely put together in the South China Morning Post, that China was not going to buckle, even though they were under a strain of the dollar. And they were upset because, you know, they're not part of the swap line agreement. So they're not getting those dollars, not directly anyway. So all of this is going on. So it made me think, to me, there's a Navarro, what I call the Navarro doctrine, which Trump sometimes bites into, which is, if it's bad for China, it must be good for the U.S. And so they must have read that article about the stress in the funding markets in China. Well, a strong dollar was caused. Okay, must be good. So Trump comes out and speaks about it. It was inane, so much so that Rich Miller, in reporting, you know, went and sought out a comment from somebody I respect. I don't know how Daniel feels, but I'll bet he does. Maurice Abstrup, who called it really absurd that at this point in time, you know, as I said, it's the three wrongs. It's the wrong time. It's the wrong policy. And it's the wrong issue to be even discussing. That's the way I feel about it. So I'm glad Daniel covered it. And then we'll eventually get to Europe about this.
Yeah, and speaking of Europe, Daniel, do you think that the European Monetary Union is using this opportunity of the COVID crisis to address issues with the euro and the EMU in terms of a European bond and issues with negative interest rates, perhaps going to a government-based cryptocurrency?
I don't think it's going to be easy. The Eurozone right now is facing almost a repeat. It's almost like a rerun of 2011, in which you see massive imbalances being built in the southern economies, in Spain and Italy in particular, because of the coronavirus impact, but also because of legacy issues that we are seeing, for example, in the mismanagement of budgets in the last 3 to 2 years, respectively. What I think is that the European Union is trying to do something that is extremely difficult, if not impossible, which is to, on one side, keep the euro as a strong currency that is widely seen as credible, and at the same time, increasing dramatically the supply of euros in the economy. Because at the same time, what we're seeing is that what kept the euro reasonably afloat, which was a massive trade surplus of the eurozone, is more than offset in an environment of a crisis in which the trade surplus is coming down, which collapses. And at the same time, you have the ECB injecting trillions of euros into the economy. So it's very, very difficult. And it's very difficult because there is no trust between the Eurozone countries. It's not just no trust between the North and the South, which is very simplistic. It's no trust between any of the countries, and let alone between France and Germany, about the direction in which the Eurozone has to go. And in this case, France is siding with Spain and Italy about a gigantic euro bond, a perpetual bond at no rate financed by everybody. And on the other side, you have Holland and Luxembourg and Germany, etc., that basically find that is going to generate a much much larger problem further down the line. So Ms. Lagarde finds herself in a very tough situation because the ECB wasted precious years in which it could have, I wouldn't have said tightened, but it could have done something to address the monetary policy that it was implementing. There was absolutely no need in the second part of the mandate of Mr. Draghi to continue injecting euros into the economy to buy sovereign bonds at negative nominal or real yields. There was absolutely no need. There was demand from the market to buy sovereign bonds almost without limits. Remember that that was a time in which Argentina issued a 100-year bond at 7.5% yield, believe it or not, and it was three times oversubscribed in a country that in the previous 100 years had defaulted 8 times. It was 3 times oversubscribed. So there was such demand. There was no need for the euro or for the ECB to be making asset purchases in that environment. And now that's coming back to bite it. Because right now what is happening is that you're seeing that bond yields in Spain and Italy are rising despite massive repurchases. You are seeing that a lot of the tools that it had have been more than consumed. So I find it very, very difficult on the fiscal side and on the government side to reach an agreement for the type of euro bond that the southern countries need. This is the key thing. The type of euro bond or solidarity mechanisms, there are and there will be. The problem is the size, because what we're dealing with here is that we probably will see countries like Spain and Italy having not 10% deficits in 2020,
the 10% deficit in 2021, in 2022, and in 2023. Which means debt to GDPs of 130, 140 for Spain, and getting to almost Japan levels in Italy, for example. So it's not going to be very easy, because there's been so much extra effort wasted in the growth times that it's going to be extremely difficult for the Eurozone to achieve the type of support that is being built in the economy right now. Think about this. In our estimates, just the recapitalization of the economy, considering private and public sector, it's going to be about 3 to 4 trillion euros alone in 1 year. And this is including, obviously, that they will probably bail out the airlines and the auto sector and the agricultural sector, all of those things. No? So it's going to be very, very challenging. At one point, I said it the other day in a debate, somebody was saying, are you in favor or against a 1.5 trillion euro bond? I don't care. I don't care. It's not enough. It doesn't even start the problem. It doesn't even start to address the problem that is building up in the Eurozone.
And your thoughts, Ira, for the EMU?
Well, Daniel's point is up, but because I don't live in Europe and I don't have to. if I was Christine Lagarde, okay, because they need a euro bond. Because if you don't have a euro bond, you may as well end the whole damn thing. It's a facade. And because the question ultimately becomes, whose euro is it? Is it the Netherlands and the Germans' euro and the Austrians and the Finns? Or is it the rest of their euro? If it's not theirs, then the others should leave. But of course, they can't leave because everything he said about Draghi and the time he wasted, but he only knew what to do one thing. And okay, do more. And it was negative. And everybody was angry about it. The insurance companies, the pension, banks. It was not a good thing. And he could have stepped off and seen the way events actually unfolded. But, you know, once central bankers get on a path, very hard, as we see, to get them to change course. And I think Christine Lagarde, who I was not a big fan of, by the way, doing this, is absolutely right on target. But if she really steps up here, because here's what we do know. We do know that if they were actually to create a euro bond, that certain elements in Germany will go back to Karlsruhe and try to get the court to declare it unconstitutional, because, of course, it would be stepping on Wolfgang Schäuble's toes, and he'll be furious. European Court of Justice, which is the greatest misnomer in modern times. Or it's an oxymoron, I guess, like military intelligence at times. But it's they'll always find in favor of the ECB. But the Eurobond, it doesn't matter. The balance sheet at the ECB is so big that they can just fold that balance sheet into a Eurobond and just do it already. Because if the Germans were to say, okay, we're not going to do this, it's not going to happen, great. Because what everybody forgets, and all you do is have to look at the European Banking Index to understand, European banks are so flooded with Italian and Spanish and other debts, because when you had negative interest rates, everybody was busy chasing something with a plus sign on it. So they're all loaded with it, and they'll get killed. And the Germans can and the Dutch can balk all they want. The fact of the matter is that if Lagarde really were to call the question and threaten all of them, and I'll tell you, if I was her, here would be my threat. Okay, you don't want a euro bond? The court's already declared that I could take QE. Well, you know what? The bond purchases, and it's going to cover a whole litany of things. I'm going to increase them by $2 trillion starting tomorrow. What's the difference? The Germans are trapped. They're trapped. They can't get out. Because if the Germans leave, What Daniel talked about is a deflationary spiral. You, as they say, you ain't seen nothing yet, because a financial collapse in Europe would send the world into an absolute deflationary spiral that would mimic a whirling dervish. That's how dramatic the collapse would be, because the entire banking edifice in Europe collapses. I see no way around it. So Lagarde really has a strong hand here, and it's time for call to question already, because Daniel's 100% right. This euro bond needs to be $2-4 trillion now, and just acquiesce to what the inevitable is so you get the best result. And if anybody tells me, and I'm sure Daniel gets this all the time, about what a great job Angela Merkel has done, Mario Draghi could never have done what he did, which is, to me, trapping Germany ultimately, without Angela Merkel running interference for him and protecting him. So this all falls back on the feet of Angela Merkel. She cannot get away from this. And it's time for Christine Lagarde. Go ahead, challenge it and call it out and get it done already, because actually the world needs it.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. Yeah, I completely agree. I think that one of the, I think that that is a critical point, what you just mentioned, is that there might be a disagreement about a Eurobond, but there's a way out for that, which is a perpetual QE of no limit QE. No? And that has already been, that problem is already out of any sort of legal type of situation. Now, the question is, and this is the key part, the question is that in the case of the Eurozone, the transmission mechanism of monetary policy is so poor in terms of effectiveness that it is very unlikely to achieve what the Fed achieves. Why? It's very simple. There's a figure that very, very few people in Europe talk about, but it's a fact, is that 80% of the real economy in the Eurozone is financed through the banking channel. In the United States, that's not even close to 15%. And it's a much more varied and much more diverse type of mechanism of transmission of monetary policy that allows it to get to the real economy. Because it goes through the banking channel in the Eurozone, the first recipients of money creation, the first recipients always is government current spending. Government current spending that goes through the banking channel into, as I was saying, in the massive amount of sovereign bonds that banks have in their balance sheet. So the reason why it doesn't incentivize job creation as much, or incentivize credit growth, or incentivize business, is because money creation, which is never neutral, but in this case even worse, is brutally geared towards current spending from governments. And none of the governments of the Eurozone are willing or able, actually, to reduce government spending relative to GDP, because they keep repeating themselves the trap of austerity was the problem when there was no austerity in the Eurozone. If you call austerity spending 40% of GDP every year, that's pretty crazy. So that generates a very, very, very challenging problem to me. The problem is not just addressing the financial and fiscal problem of the pandemic today, is that it is very likely to generate a very poor multiplier effect in the future, just as we saw after 2014.
Interesting. And the last question for today is, what investing or trading strategies make sense in this environment as it evolves? Daniel?
Ultimately, it has to be decided by the appetite for risk and the ability to take risk that the investor has. from in my perspective, the trends that we have seen in the last 3 to 4 years are likely to be perpetuated. So you need to have exposure to dollar-based assets, and you need to have exposure to gold and precious metals to as a decorrelated asset relative to the rest particularly relative to bonds and equities. I personally, in equities, I don't see the relative opportunity of emerging economies relative to developed economies. To get the same level of returns in the past 5 years, you have basically had to take between 3 to 5 times more risk. So, and obviously, if you're an investor in equities, there are three things that you cannot count on in the next 3 years. One is dividends. The second is buybacks. And the third is that you're going to have the level of multiple expansion that we saw between 2009 and 2018. So, you know, I think that if you stay on the safer side of the asset structure, you're going to be, if monetary policy and fiscal policy actually generate some level of growth and things go back to normal, you're going to achieve positive returns with the market. But the situation right now is so skewed to the downside. And again, the markets are not significantly cheaper. They've fallen a lot, but so have earnings estimates. So the problem that I have is that if you stay too close to the most cyclical side of the economy, there's a disproportionate level of risk relative to the return that you might get in any case. So if I'm right and we go into a deflationary spiral, that's followed by stagflation, you probably need to be closer to those, to dollars, gold, and the safest part of the asset structure, and as far away from what is most exposed to the cycle and obviously I would look at banks with a lot of caution, the financial sector.
And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, very similar. I think stock buybacks and dividends willy-nilly, you know, if you're a good enough company, you really are generating cash. But there is now a sense that corporations need to practice some sense of fiduciary responsibility with what they do with their capital, because the last few years we've seen they come into a crisis. And they're not prepared for it. Look at the airline. Airline says it more because they've been cash cows. They got nothing because it was all paid out, and that means that the structure of corporate pay is going to change dramatically. Because let's face it, a lot of those buybacks, and I've never been a fan of buybacks, and I'm not a fan of companies who do buybacks, because my sense was always if they're so good, who would be selling stock? The stock, you know, why would you be selling it? It's kind of insane. Yeah. But I always believe in the back of my mind, in today's world for the last 35 years anyway, since the Chicago School, Merton Miller and Company, and Eugene Fama, with the dispersal of dividends to shareholders, that has been the emphasis. But there's also been so many stock options issued to management that a lot of stock buybacks are just to prevent a dissolution from all the exercising of options. So it's just money transferring hands from shareholders to management anyway. No getting around it. So I think that's going to be slowed down. I think Daniel's 100% right. Dividends will only be from companies who can really generate it and not borrowing money like they've been doing to ensure you know, that they have favor with investors.
Yeah.
So I think that is over. The metals, it's not that I'm a gold bug, and I'm not, but precious metals have again proven their value as stores of value, because that's what real currencies exhibit two key properties, which is a medium of exchange and a store of value. And I'm not as certain about the dollar. I think the dollar is on a short-term positive here only because of the massive amount of borrowing, and there is a short-term need. And as look at the commodity indexes, they're at, you know, 40, 50-year lows here, which is, if we go back to the second week of January, they were starting to break out of resistance patterns, and it looked like we were on for a nice year with emerging markets and commodity prices. Boy, have things changed in 2.5 months' time, you know, 3 months' time, they've changed dramatically. And that deflationary spiral is staring us in the face. And again, let's hope that the Europeans do something right for a change. And I agree with Daniel, certain banks will do well here. The banks that truly are the backbone of their systems as far as facilitating government policy, the rest are not going to perform their way. There's just not going to be any money to make. And we've seen it in Europe. You know, every time somebody says, oh, you're doom and gloom, I said, I'm not doom and gloom. Look at the damn banks. Look at Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank, which was the crown jewel of the European banking, of the European banking system. And as Daniel rightly points out, 80% corporate finance and small and medium business finance is done through banks, not the bond market as it is in the United States and, you know, other shadow banking types of sectors. So all you do is have to look at that and say, well, there is something so broken here. Well, a lot of it is by the hands of Mario Draghi, but the banks haven't really done well by themselves anyway. And their whole, it's all broken. Where do you go? I don't know. Right now I'm in a more wealth preservation. I certainly am not buying the long end of the bond market, even with a deflation sphere in my head, because rates are already so low and they're being artificially held, especially here in the United States and in Europe. And if Lagarde ramps up, as I think she's going to do, because she's going to show the Germans and the Dutch that they really don't have a leg to stand on and they're really not in control as she's in control. And if she ramps up the QE for another billion, or another trillion, I'm sorry, a trillion, 2 trillion, that'll put a ceiling on how high rates can go. But I don't want any part of it because I just, in a year's time, I don't know where this goes. I don't know where this goes. And I'm not of the MMT crowd that, well, you know, you raise taxes if you need to, if inflation starts to head up. No, that's not going to work. And I'm not in favor of having a bonfire of the vanities and burning all the bonds and having a debt jubilee, because as attractive as that is on some levels, it's not very attractive on other levels. And the Austrian school really has shown its strength again by understanding the concept of debt and the role that debt plays in society. I'll always be much more a Schumpeterian than I will any other economist, because I think he had it more right than others. And it's just not for creative destruction, but the whole concept of debt and when we go into these types of situations. But I'm very cautious going forward here. I would not rush. Anybody who thinks this is a V recovery, you've been hanging around on Wall Street too long.
Great insight. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Daniel?
Well, it's quite easy to find me. You can find me on Twitter and my website. Twitter is at DLACALLE_IA. My website, www.DLACALLE.com. And obviously, you can find me on Amazon. And it's quite difficult not to find me. So if anybody has problems.
And Ira?
You can go to YRAHarris, HARRIS.com. Notes from Underground will pop up, and any other place where I'm at. Hopefully I'll still be sitting director of the CME. The elections are in 2 weeks, and hopefully I'll be returned to my post. I'm not sure though. So I can be, hopefully we'll be able to be found there. But most of my work on the blog and through FRA and other podcasts, because I'm out there in the podcast world. So YouTube has really a bunch of them. So, I relish this opportunity to be able to connect with you, Richard, and of course with people like Daniel. This is important. Whether you agree with us or not agree with us, doesn't matter. We're there to help bring some light into some of these dark corners.
Great. Thank you very much.
I completely agree with that.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.